episode 49.
The biggest secret of the best traders in the world is that they're just like everyone else. However, they've worked hard to learn the markets and discover what works and what doesn't. But how can you hear about these journeys and get in on the strategies and tactics they use? You can do it by listening to Chat with Traders. Here's your host, Aaron Fifield.
What's up, guys? What's going on? Glad you could join me for episode 49. Thank you very much for tuning in. Now, I have a very special guest on the podcast this week who I'm excited to introduce you to. His name is Hayne Bodek, although some refer to him as the Algo Arms Dealer, and I totally understand why. Hayne began his trading career at Hull Trading, a prestigious firm well known for driving forward innovation in the domain of automated trading. Following Hull, Hayne then went into significant roles at Goldman Sachs and UBS, which are all discussed during the interview. But to further set the scene, in 2007, Hayne founded Trading Machines, a high-frequency trading operation, and at the peak, Trading Machines accounted for 0.5% of all options trading volume with a team of 25, one of who was Brian Weiner from episode 40. All was well for a couple years until the beginning of 2009, when Trading Machines ran into issues and began to bleed money for unknown reasons. Until Hayne later discovered at the root of the problem was secretive order types being used by a select few firms, giving them an unfair advantage to front-run the orders of other participants. With this discovery, Hayne went to the SEC to raise his concern about such order types, and little did he know at the time that this would be the beginning for one of the most sophisticated and complex investigations carried out by the SEC in US history. So, of course, we speak about all of this in much more detail during the interview. And we also speak about another fascinating topic, which is the payment for order flow. Hayne shares with us what is really happening to your orders after you click the button to buy or sell. And you might even be surprised to find out that a large majority of retail orders never even make it to an exchange. So just from listening to this interview, you'll quickly realize Hayne has an incredible knowledge of market microstructure. And in case you find that some parts are a little technical, then this may be one episode worth a second run. Just while you're listening, I'd love it if you could please leave a brief review on the podcast in iTunes. It's a very quick and easy way to support Chat with Traders. All you need to do is go to chatwithtraders.com/iTunes and follow the prompts. That will be a huge help, so thank you. All right, it's time. I'm your host, Aaron Fifield. This is the Chat with Traders podcast, and please welcome my guest for this week's interview, Hayne Bodek. Hayne, welcome to the podcast, man. How's it going?
Going well. How are you doing?
I am excellent. Thank you. And thank you very much for doing this. It's great to be speaking with you. Now, here's how I picture the interview playing out. So we'll have three major talking points, right? They'll be walking through the roles you've had over the years. So working at Hull, Goldman, UBS, and of course, Trading Machines. And secondly, really keen to get into the topic of blowing the whistle on HFT secretive order types, and then what's happening to retail order flow. So if that sounds good to you, let's dig into it.
Okay.
Awesome. So Hayne, share with us how you got started in finance and what was it like to work at Hull Trading? Because, I mean, just quickly, from my understanding, they were a very prestigious firm regarded by many as pioneers in the realm of automated trading. So what was that like?
Yeah, well, I'm still pretty nostalgic about the experience, and I know a lot of my former colleagues also are. I got into Hull, I guess most people who joined the firm probably had unusual backgrounds that were relevant. I started out working under an entrepreneurial professor named Bob Grossman, doing credit card fraud detection using machine learning algorithms. So I was really kind of oriented around large data, detecting patterns, and had some good successes with that project with Visa. And at the time, there was a lot of hype about using those methods in finance. And it was kind of funny, but there was actually an advertisement that said, you know, wanted, you know, individual who to use you know, machine learning algorithms to forecast markets. So I applied and got the job.
Excellent. So what was your role at Hull Trading there? Like, what were you doing on a day-to-day basis?
Well, the role changed. I mean, I was still very green. And Hull was a good environment for they really focused on taking scientists or other technical types and, you know, basically grooming them. You know, I was probably in the financial engineering group one of the stronger programmers. And there was a lot of competition for, like, the pure quant jobs. And I kind of started out, you know, working on machine learning and forecasting. Then I started to work on basically the data infrastructure for all the financial engineering models. And eventually that kind of led into a role where I was one of the few people who focused on the on the intersection between what we think of as the three disciplines in the field. So at Hull, there was basically a financial engineering group, which is the quants. You had a technology group where the developers, you know, were situated. And then you had trading. And Hull traded on the floor. They also traded electronically. And my role kind of evolved to be the guy who sat in between those groups. Eventually, it was in the early 2000s, the role that I had at Hull started to actually have a name. You know, people had a hard time describing what I did, but we call it strategy now, and it's basically the algorithmic trading part of this type of business. So I started to focus on quite literally the intersection in terms of how those three functional areas, trading, financial engineering, and technology, were actually all bound into a system that could execute trades strategically, you know, on the exchanges.
Right, okay. And after Hull was acquired by Goldman Sachs, what happened next? Is that when you went to UBS, or did you stay on at Goldman for a while there?
Yeah, I stayed on for a while. It was actually a pretty interesting and difficult time because Goldman actually acquired Spear Leeds and Kellogg, you know, the very big NYSE specialist operation, and there was basically an integration effort between Hull, SLK, and Goldman. And a lot of people burned out on that. That was a pretty, I don't know what the word is, but ambitious integration. And I think the guys who were probably the happiest there were people who found roles at Goldman that were, that leveraged their skill set, but wasn't really in the middle of this very difficult integration of these businesses. So you actually saw quite a lot of attrition over that period, and people from the firm ended up setting up and joining other desks, and that's really how the DNA got around the street. I joined UBS after that. A group of guys went there, and I joined up with that group and focused mostly on the U.S. operation. And in about 2 years, we kind of replicated the entire kind of business model that we had done at Hull. So it was a pretty successful group. It was called EVT, Electronic Volatility Trading. And, I guess, towards the end of my stay there, probably I think the last year and a half, I took over the group globally as co-head.
Okay. So that's a pretty major role, isn't it?
Yeah. I benefited from the fact that, the things that I focused on, what we had in the early 2000s, mid 2000s options industry is we had the markets were basically going from floor-based exchanges to hybrid, which was a combination of floor and electronic, to purely electronic. And they're really, because the floor was, you know, primarily how business was conducted in the option space, there really weren't a lot of people who did what I did. I kind of cut my teeth working on European options in the late 90s, and those markets were automated. So, you know, my career basically, I got a leg up on a lot of the other people because as markets went electronic, you know, a guy who, what is my task? My task is to put literally 300,000 or 400,000 bids and offers across 500 names, you know, hundreds of options per name. And I have to put all those out and do it in a manner, you know, where we don't lose money. I mean, you think about it, it's about making money, but there's been some pretty big blow-ups in the options market making space because of how difficult it is to actually trade that many different securities and react, really within milliseconds to the changing prices of them.
Okay, excellent. That's really interesting. Now, this is what I'm really keen to hear more about. So tell us about trading machines. What motivated you to start the firm? How did you go about it? And what type of operation was this?
Yeah, well, I guess in 2007, the options market in the U.S. had what was known as the penny pilot, and there were 13 names that were quoted in pennies instead of the nickel increments that had existed beforehand. And when I looked at how those names were trading, I thought to myself that these products were actually quite similar to maybe how the Korean market traded, and I came to the conclusion that the way that market making would operate in the U.S. would necessarily have to change. So basically, the margins would be so thin that option market makers wouldn't be able to do traditional bid offer capture or spread capture is what we call it sometimes. So I kind of came to the conclusion that I was going to have to rebuild and that it was going to have to be a we were fast at the time, but I kind of felt we needed to really pursue the low latency game harder than maybe what was possible at a bank. And at that time there were many high frequency trading firms in the equities universe that were really pushing the arms race there. And to just kind of give you some more color, it's a very complicated decision I made, to leave and go do my own firm. But we also had the integration of stock exchanges and option exchanges. The stock exchanges purchased the option exchanges, and then they cut the option exchanges over onto the stock technology platforms. And then over that time, they started to roll out, the stock market has certain business models. One's called the maker-taker system, which is a system where two individuals trade and one gets a rebate. We'll talk about that maybe later in the interview, but the other guy pays a fee. And you start getting all this, I thought of it as cross-contamination. You got all this stock market, high-frequency trading tradition started kind of molding into, into the option space. And then you also had some of these HFT firms, which were doing very well, start to set up options operations and compete in the options space. So in this period of transition, I felt that I needed to be ahead of the game, and so I needed to go build a new, an entirely new business model. Originally we were going to go to basically a hedge fund that was affiliated with an investment bank. But then it kind of evolved, and I realized I could go independent. So we set up Trading Machines, and it was basically a high-frequency trading firm for options. We traded. We hired from all the major operations. We tried to get people who had that kind of expertise. I think at our peak were about 25 people, and we launched into the market, and we traded pretty consistently about 0.5% of the U.S. options market over the lifetime of the firm, when it was actively trading.
Yeah, that's really impressive that you were doing such high volume. I mean, 0.5% of all options trading, that's very significant. So that volume, just so we understand, that volume was, that's spread across lots and lots of small trades, or alternatively spread across a few larger trades?
No, yeah, spread across lots and lots of small trades. Because of how the stock market worked, we ended up doing a lot more, many more transactions in the stock market than in the options market. But still, it was, definitely, as far as like high frequency trading options goes, we were the closest thing to it. We specialized in basically operating as an informal market maker. Very much the way the high-frequency traders now work, where they don't necessarily have market-making status or obligations. So we would basically, opportunistically provide liquidity or take liquidity in names when we identified mispricings. And we centered a lot of the business over a short-term intraday volatility forecasting, and that was kind of our bread and butter.
Okay. So to summarize, where was your edge at Trading Machines? Was it essentially the speed of execution? Was it the number of trades? Or was it the complexity? Because you were running over a million lines of code. So I'd love it if you could expand on this, please.
Well, the edge, I mean, I don't really think of speed as an edge in the way people talk about it. Speed is basically used when you have a competitive relationship with other traders out there. So if you guys are both triggered by the same events to try to go after the same trade, then speed matters because you need to be faster than the other guy. That will tend to occur in the options space. If a stock moves, the options, the theoretical values change, and there'll be a race to kind of hit the quotes that are stale out in the market or resting orders. And then there, the market makers who are, and call it high frequency option traders, everyone's trying to hit the mispriced options, but they're also trying to cancel and update their quotes, which are stale. So there's that's kind of the arms race that we have. I don't really think in any kind of efficient market that becomes your bread and butter. You have to have something more than that. We focus quite a bit, as I said, on the volatility piece. This is the implied volatility. In many ways, that can be a surrogate for supply and demand in the options for basically buying pressure or selling pressure. So we tended to develop models where we can get the right side of that pressure to either buy or sell options. And the other thing that most people don't understand about the options business, which is really absolutely necessary and central to the way we get an edge, is really, we'll call it risk management, but it doesn't mean the same thing it means in, let's say, the stock or futures world. Risk management and options is really about finding the most effective and cheapest hedge for previous trades that you've done. And that tends to mean that every single trade you do has a component of it in which it's either beneficial to you from a risk management perspective, or the opposite, or increases your risk. And options are can change quite dramatically over the day, and if you do not actually manage your portfolio, which will be very complex, with incredible precision, you basically will not be able to lock in or realize any of the alpha that you have in a way that isn't exposed to what we call adverse selection or slippage.
Okay, that's really interesting. Now, the Wall Street Code, the documentary that you were featured in, at one point, the voiceover said, and I'm paraphrasing here, you had written an algorithm that would generate a guaranteed income. So I'm really curious to know, how was this possible to guarantee an algorithm would always win?
A lot of the stuff that has hit the media or that's in a documentary, there's always some kind of translation there. Okay, so this guaranteed profit that is talked about in various manner in the HFT industry or I was in the high frequency option industry, even if you have some type of pure arbitrage, you still have execution risk, right? This kind of guaranteed return isn't really the right way to describe the activity. But there are strategies that, if they have very high execution certainty and very aggressive and tight and precise risk management, can basically approximate they will appear to have a very stable return, and the positions that they create are, in our case, we did actually try to target positions that were approximations of what would be riskless portfolios. So, there's a tradition to target that, but that doesn't mean you actually can achieve it. As I said, the execution risk, the risk that you cannot actually execute the legs of the strategy effectively and costly and cost effectively. That's not one of the main things that's going to stop any strategy that's going after a guaranteed profit. But when you look at these businesses, when they're the types of strategies that statement may have referred to, they'll tend to have very high. I don't know if your listeners are familiar with metrics like the Sharpe ratio, but it's a measure of risk over return versus some type of benchmark. Those metrics for the HFT business will be very, very high. And the P&L distributions, lots and lots of trades, they will look, many of the businesses will look like literally very close to a straight line in terms of profit. That was the case actually for the portfolio we ran at Trading Machines on a gross basis, but gross P&L, looked very, very, the slope of that was pretty, pretty straight, but the, we had a lot of difficulty with fee structure, and the fees, had quite a adverse impact on us, especially the fees associated with stock trading and hedging.
Okay, very interesting. That was well said, Haim. Thanks for really explaining that to us. Around 2009, Trading Machines began to lose money. So tell us about this time. I believe it was about 12 months before you even got to the root of the problem. So what was going on? What was that time like for you during those 12 months?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, what happened, so we were basically building the year that Regulation NMS was rolled out. And that body of regulation really restructured how the U.S. stock market operated. I guess it did also apply to the options market. But It had features that were basically problematic for high frequency trading strategies in the stock universe. So what happened is that, you know, from 2007 to 2009, the exchanges basically started to create features, primarily features that were requested by high frequency trading firms in the stock market. And these, particularly, they created order types and what I call order matching engine called practices. They basically modified the order handling of the stock exchanges. And the period of some of the most intense modification was over the period of 2009. Now, my firm had launched trading in August of 2008, and we launched a month before the financial crisis struck. And then, you know, after that, you had just incredible market conditions and volatilities that were 200% volatilities. You know, you had such anomalous markets, and there was a lot of dislocation and a lot of edge. So I did not really appreciate I was not really able to witness the called the nuances and how the stock market had changed. I mean, I do actually remember it was December 2008 was the first time I started seeing odd behavior in my stock executions. And you know, what I did is I started to avoid venues that I thought were just toxic, right? That, you know, that were lots of us in the business are trying to trade against order flow that isn't informed, and you know, some venues have a different composition than others. And my initial thought was, hey, these particular trading venues are toxic, and I basically tuned my system to trade on the venues that were, that looked better. And what happened is, in the end, I started, you know, having more and more of my trading concentrated in only a few venues. So I had kind of learned that most of the market was toxic. And what had actually happened over that period of time is the exchanges were modifying how their systems worked and introducing features that basically supercharged the profits of these high-frequency stock traders. These features were introduced without adequate disclosure, and you know, the exchanges were in no way, they would visit all their clients, but they weren't talking about the high-frequency trading features with any, you know, with the firms that looked like they were the counterparty to high frequency traders. So, you know, we must have looked like, what an exchange would call a customer, right? Whereas certain high frequency trading firms in stock would be thought of as liquidity providers. So customers were basically not really informed about these order types. And, the exchanges would come in and give you all this information on how they operated, but just miss. You know, they just kind of skip over anything that had to do with the kind of features that high frequency traders were actually requesting at that time. So what happened? It's kind of a long story here, but what happened in May 2009 is that the last exchange in the U.S. Basically modified its order handling to accommodate HFT, and that was Direct Edge. They introduced an order type called high dot slide, and what I try to explain to people is when you introduce a particular order type, it doesn't just have features in its intrinsic to itself and how it operates, but the actual code in terms of how the electronic exchange works and how its order matching engine works has to be modified and has to define how does that order type interact with the other order types, right? And that's something I've tried to explain in my book, The Problem HFT. It's not just, you know, that metaphorically the exchanges are introducing a queen onto the checkerboard. They're also defining how that queen interacts with other pieces. And it turned out that the pieces or the order types I were using were heavily disadvantaged by in the interaction with the hide not slide order type. So really what happened is we just started bleeding, and it looked like my guys rolled out a bug. I was actually my sister's wedding in late May 2009. I was gone for a week, and I came back, and the stock trading had changed in to a point where we were basically making money in the options and hemorrhaging all of it into the stock market. And it was quite perplexing because a change like that is usually triggered by a software release or a mistake that the trading firm does. So it didn't really, you know, I've been in the business for over a decade at that time, and it just was not clear to me. There wasn't like a circular or you know, any type of information that had been delivered to me specifically that had indicated that exchange should change their market structure. There's somewhat of a paper trail, but it was such an extreme change, and it wasn't really communicated to the client, to the members of the exchange in the way that it should have been. So I'm sitting there, and it just didn't occur to me that this type of what really looked like a bug, you know, hemorrhaging this money, was actually just the exchange redefining how my orders interacted with HFT orders, and literally just rolling out code that changed how my trading operated.
Okay. Yeah. So I appreciate you explaining that for us. That's really insightful. And shortly after you spoke out about this and revealed your concern to the SEC, why did you decide to blow the whistle on these secretive HFT order types?
That's a long story. I didn't really know what I was getting into. there's a tradition. Blair Hull, founder of Hull Trading, you know, he went on the record and called out the NASDAQ market maker collusion and what was known as the Christie Schultz scandal. That was an episode in kind of stock market history where NASDAQ market makers were colluding and keeping spreads artificially wide. And a pair of academic researchers discovered this and wrote a paper, why do these market makers avoid odd prices, really, is what they had discovered. And, you know, why are they skipping every other price and keeping the spreads are artificially wide because of that. And turned out that, you know, they were colluding, and the industry was actually fined, I think, close to $1 billion in penalties because of this activity. And Blair was one of the first insiders to actually go on the record, and I think it was in the LA Times, and actually, note a particular name, and that, he basically got a phone call from the market maker telling him to get out of his game, and he went on the record on it. Another example is one of the great kind of leaders in the options industry, Tom Peterfree, for 5 years was lobbying heavily and very vocal about eliminating a loophole that allowed Q jumping, the same kind of stuff I turned in the stock market. There was actually a kind of a Q jumping loophole in the options market where we call them customer market makers or barnacles, but basically professional traders learned that they could masquerade as retail customers and get customer priority and leap ahead of the other market makers. And he was very, very as I said, vocal, and I think has deserves a lot of the credit for what eventually happened, was 2010, the options market basically created a solution for this problem and eliminated it by creating what's known as the professional customer designation. So basically, if you trade too much and you try to take advantage of that loophole too much, the loophole still does exist, you actually have to change your status, and then you no longer can exploit the loophole. So here, you know, the two names, you know, big names in my industry, are both associated with significant market reform. Of course, both of them, were able to do that because they had very, very successful, operations. And I think what was different about me is I decided to call out these issues, maybe in the same style, I thought, as these other great leaders did, but I called them out after my firm failed. So I wasn't in the same kind of position that they were, and I didn't realize how important it was to be, this has taken up 5 years of my life now, and no way did I think it was going to happen.
Yeah, so I mean, it was a very bold move, and I really want everyone listening to understand how bold of a move that was. I mean, were you at all concerned about your reputation or what the repercussions might have been? I mean, even on a personal safety level, because I imagine there were many people who were upset by you doing this.
Yeah, it's funny. It was bold. I mean, I think, again, I was kind of insulated. I didn't realize how insulated I was from other parts of the industry by getting, that experience in the ivory tower. I didn't really understand, and you've probably seen, you know, last few years been quite a number of major penalties and fines. I didn't realize how prevalent it was across the industry to exploit the gray and to often cross into the black lines, between unethical behavior and, let's say, illegal behavior. It was not. Whole trading was all about being smarter than the other guy. And I kind of grew up on that. There was a former colleague of mine who said to me, he says, it ruined us. We weren't ready for the real world where it's shadier. So, I guess I didn't actually realize what I was going up against until I had already disclosed this stuff to Scott Patterson, who, started reporting on it in the Wall Street Journal. The information I gave, resulted in extensive investigations, that took 4 years. The Direct Edge case, Direct Edge was eventually fined, the largest fine in U.S. history against an exchange, which is $14 million. For improperly or inadequately disclosing their order types, right? This long, long path, which was successful in the end. That case, for example, the Direct Edge case, it was I was informed that that was the most sophisticated case that the SEC had ever done, in terms of complexity and sophistication of the abuses. So this whole process and my opponents, it started out as I thought I was going against a small segment of the industry that was, taking advantage of the system, and I was convinced at the time that it would have been discovered, by the regulators. And, halfway in, I realized that I didn't go against a small part of the industry. I went against the dominant practices in the industry. So, when you do something like this, you take a shot out and, you throw, metaphorically, you're just throwing a fist out there. You don't actually know who you're hitting. And you're right, that as you get feedback, and you know, in my case, I went against some very, very powerful, entrenched people. You know, you look at this and you're like, did I make the right move? You know, am I doing the right thing? And you get a little bit nervous and anxious, especially when the industry, I mean, you know, you get more heat and more negative feedback the more significant the issue is, and the more if you're right, you're going to get trapped for 5 years. I didn't realize that, but that's a very common experience for whistleblowers. You know, if you're wrong or it doesn't matter that much, then it just goes, you know, you might report it, but no, you know, it doesn't result in any big action. In my case, there must have been somewhere between 40 and 50 regulatory filings that exchanges were forced to provide to accurately describe how all the HFT features operated. It was a war. I don't recommend it, but it's not something I'd recommend other people to do. But how did I get through it? I just have a property. I guess it helped me out here. It's when I started to get nervous about what I was doing, I kind of doubled down on the, trying to prove I was right, and that meant that I kind of outworked a lot of people on the other side. The precision of my information basically put so it was I provided so much detail and accurate information that needed to be looked at carefully by regulators. What I believe happened is that just created so much heat on the practices that they weren't really able to mount any kind of opposition, to me. I mean, other whistleblowers will get heavily smeared. That didn't really happen with me, and that was definitely done, privately. But I didn't have to go through a big, public battle where exchanges were saying statements to kind of disprove me publicly. And I'll give you an example. Let me think. I'm forgetting actually who the there's a Nobel laureate. I'm just forgetting his name. But in the Christy Schultz case, NASDAQ hired very, very reputable people to basically attack the opposition. And it was complete. They were completely wrong. But these people that were hired, these experts, but they really made it very painful for people who were trying to turn in those practices. And in my case, it was very public. There was, let's say, a debate, but, it was a long process, but I survived it.
Oh, that's awesome. So to summarize the investigation, because this was a huge investigation, what was the outcome? Like, just to summarize it for us, what was the outcome and what's been achieved or changed since?
Well, the main thing that was achieved, you can really think of the investigations, and there were multiple ones because there were multiple targets. When the enforcement division looks at these issues, they need to come to a place where they determine. First of all, they have to look at the accuracy of the allegations, right? But then after that, they have to look at, is this unethical behavior or is it illegal behavior, right? And they have to lots of things I work on, with regard to call it regulation of high frequency trading. It's not actually clear, where that line is between unethical and illegal, and that takes a lot of very talented people with securities law background to determine. And the thing is, the SEC Enforcement Division is only going to be pursuing violations of securities law. So if the law is not violated, or maybe the law is not defined, is not defined well enough to address the issue, then it basically becomes a policy issue. So a lot of the things that I turned in ended up becoming, a policy issue, and everything really kind of revolved around disclosure. So you had the Office of Compliance Inspections and Examinations did an order type audit where they had all the exchanges submit very extensive information on how they made order types, how they disclosed them, the whole process, which ones existed. And that was actually completely a separate initiative from the enforcement investigations. And then about a year ago, Chairman Mary Jo White, she mandated that all of the exchanges use last year, this is 2014, she basically said that the exchanges needed to reassess all their regulatory filings and determine if their order types were accurately disclosed, and also to assess if the order types were operating as intended, and if there weren't unintended consequences. It was a very kind of also very significant initiative. And most of the exchanges were extremely responsive and put out a lot of revisions and clarified how their order types worked, changed certain features. There was many of the issues that I was concerned about were addressed through disclosure. I thought some of them would be ripped out that were approved. I was kind of shocked that, I've been very critical of queue jumping behavior and those that was actually approved. But, what I learned through the process is that the SEC is actually pretty liberal in terms of allowing different types of call it functionality on exchanges. They just demand that there's adequate disclosure, right?
Okay.
So that's, so in the case of Direct Edge, that's a case where, that exchange basically was not responsive enough and had significant lapses in their disclosure. I think if they had been had addressed the issues earlier and had been more cooperative, maybe you wouldn't have seen the same result.
Sure. Okay. So, Chaim, let's change gears and bring this back to a retail level. Because I know we're on some time constraints here, but the big question, does HFT affect retail traders?
Yeah, well, HFT in general affects retail traders. I would actually lean on the side of a slight positive effect. And I think what retail traders don't understand, and I really don't like the narrative that's been going on in the market structure debate or the Flash Boys debate, high frequency traders tend not to to trade on venues where they are able to trade with retail. I mean, retail orders do not, retail market orders do not tend to go to the major exchanges. And when I mean that, I mean there are reports that the retail brokers file, 606 reports, and you will see that exchanges often will have a reported zero, not a single market order was sent to that exchange. And retail traders, they send a lot of market orders. So those market orders, they don't go to the exchange where the HFT is trading. They often do not go to a dark pool. They often go to what we call an internalizer or a wholesale market maker or off-exchange market maker. What does that mean? Basically means that those orders are bought and they are traded. These off-exchange market makers will trade against those orders, those retail market orders, really without competition. So how does HFT affect that type of trading? Well, the upstairs market makers have to match the best price on the exchange, right? That's, they're basically sitting on the sidelines and they get to trade at the prices they see that really the high frequency traders are posting. So the more aggressive and the tighter that high frequency traders trade, the more that they tighten markets, they're actually squeezing the margins of the upstairs market makers. So that's why I say there's a little bit of a positive impact. And I know this from experience that when the high frequency traders came in, the upstairs market makers had actually quite a difficult time, and continue to do so because the high frequency traders tighten the markets and often would tighten them to a point where the upstairs market maker couldn't make that much money if he matched the high frequency trader's price. So that's probably not what you would expect, right? I mean, I've been extremely critical of HFT, but I will say that part of the reason they can trade so tight is they've got all those super advantages that caused me grief, right? So in a way, retail's benefiting from the fact that firms like mine were basically abused.
Okay, so something you mentioned in there, which I just want to dive into a little bit deeper and not skim over it too much, is the how does the payment for order flow works? Could you just explain that to us in a little more detail?
Yeah, it's a very old practice. It's getting a lot of attention now. We actually are seeing some class action lawsuits targeting it. Before I explain how it operates, I'll say that one of the major innovators of payment for order flow is Bernie Madoff. So, that's kind of the origin. what he did and other firms in that space is they basically buy retail order, literally buy, through a kickback, payment for order flow, we call it, and from retail brokers. So they say, look, don't send your order to the exchange. Send it to me. I'll match the exchange's price, and I'll pay you for it. And if you think about that payment, it's kind of like a profit sharing, if you think about it, right? The market maker's giving up part of the profit he would make on the spread and giving it back to the broker as a kickback. Why would an off-exchange market maker do that? Why do they do that? Well, it all has to do with this concept of what we call adverse selection. But basically, when you trade out in the market and you're posting your quotes, you basically are giving all of the sharks in the market, all the other fast firms, the option to trade you against you when you're wrong. Maybe you're not fast enough updating your quotes. Maybe you're providing liquidity to a huge let's say a large pension that their order is going to move the market. And market makers don't want to trade against order flow that moves the price against them, because then they just lose money. So retail is very, very attractive because it tends to be small, and smaller orders don't move the market as frequently as larger orders. But the other thing about it, and I know retail guys probably don't like this, but statistically, it looks uninformed. I mean, you can look at large volume of trades of retail traders, and you can see, what is the, what is the kind of average alpha or average information. Information edge, let's call it, right? That these orders have, and the answer is zero. It's near zero. So when you trade against a retail guy, you make very close to the actual spread. When you trade against a pension or a mutual fund, you actually get a lot of adverse selection or bleed, and that will look like. That's basically price movement that erodes your profit. You don't make the full spread when you trade against other types of counterparties. So it's actually quite simple. It sounds complicated, but it's just I'm gonna say it again in a very simple way. It's like the way I'm actually look kind of down on these guys. It's like there's an upstairs market maker. He can't compete in the regular market that well. So he basically buys orders from, buys dummies. He wants dummies to trade with, and he basically pays brokers to send them the dummies. These firms that have been engaged in this have had, many of them have gone under in the last 15 years, and Madoff's obviously was one of the biggest, and that whole entire business collapsed. It actually was rebranded as Surge Trading, I think, and still went under. These firms, were really unable to develop market making operations that could compete in the regular exchanges. The HFTs basically were more sophisticated compared to these kind of upstairs market makers. So, I do give credit to the HFTs for, being able to trade, even though I'm very, really against the cheats and the unlevel playing field. They are able to make markets in the exchanges aggressively, and that's good. Otherwise, we just have these other guys just cherry picking off exchange, and then we'd have wide spreads. It'd be worse.
Okay, so just to wrap this up for us, is the retail trader disadvantaged in any way by the way that the payment for order flow works?
Well, disadvantaged, there's definitely arguments to be made that that the order handling is not optimal, and that is really there's certain firms that are now have lawsuits against them because they handled orders to basically maximize the kickbacks, right? Well, the problem with maximizing the kickbacks, I'll give you a very clear example here. If I'm a retail broker and I go to market maker says he's gonna he's gonna pay me a quarter penny per share for my orders, right? He could actually give me a kickback, or if I was looking to get my customers the best execution, I might say, hey, don't give me the kickback. Just give me a quarter penny price improvement. Give me a better price for every single share you trade, right? So these brokers actually have a choice. They can actually negotiate to get you a better price, or they can just, take the kickback and pocket it. And what they do is they know that the regulators are concerned about the level, the amount of price improvement. So what they'll tend to do is give a de minimis price improvement. They'll basically say, look, give me a little bit of price improvement on average versus, you know, what might have been available on exchanges, and then give me all the rest of it as a kickback, right? On top of that, they will basically, as I said, send orders to either trading venues, and it's complicated, I don't want to get to all of it, but basically trading venues also have rebates or kind of a payment for a flow arrangement. When a broker basically maximizes the kickbacks that they get, not only are they not passing on the value of those kickbacks to their traders in the form of price improvement, but the places that have the highest kickbacks tend to be the places, especially if we're talking about trading venues, which are the most expensive to trade for the liquidity, for the other side of the trade. So what that basically means is you don't get filled as frequently if you try to maximize rebates and kickbacks. So very simply here, retail traders should be getting, significant price improvement. They're not getting it. The way things are routed now are probably dramatically reducing their fill rates for orders that they post. So if you're a retail trader and you post orders and you don't get filled frequently, what you should know is that your broker has a lot of options for trying to get that order done. And if you're not getting filled, maybe your broker is not sending those orders to places where they're likely to get filled because he's trying to maximize kickback. So these are all the details about it. But the other thing I'll point out is the all these payments and kickbacks I'm talking about, they are very significant. Some brokers will get close to like 50% of their net income from this these types of payments. But these brokers are basically charging commissions that are ridiculously high when compared to the kickbacks. So, I guess I would say that the commissions are even more egregious for many of the retail brokers than all of the funny business I just spoke about. And there's a deep irony there because the reason why the SEC permits all the kickbacks is the argument is it's supposed to reduce the commission rates. That's the whole reason they're permitted. And so for a trader to pay high commissions, retail trader, get very little price improvement, and have their their orders have lower fill rates because they're routed incorrectly, and for their broker to be getting 50% of their net income by monetizing that trader's order is basically, from my perspective, the retail broker is basically just stealing money from the trader. And what should he do? There's the answer. The trader should move to there's certain firms that will, some firms charge $8 or $9 for a 100-share order, and others charge a dollar or less. And retail traders, I'm just shocked why anybody would go to the traditional retail brokers when there are firms that cater to semi-pro kind of people. If I'm going to open up a retail account, I'm going to open it up at a broker that caters to high volume active traders who are demanding that their costs are less than a dollar for every 100 shares.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, This is a fascinating subject, and I mean, this whole conversation has been really fascinating. I know we could keep going on for much longer yet, but I know you've got to run. So, I mean, thank you very much for doing this. I really appreciate you coming on. Before you do go, can you share with listeners where they can go to find out more about you and where can they connect with you?
Oh, yeah. Well, first thing you should do, if you're interested in any of this stuff, I tend to tweet quite frequently. I usually tweet about, the regulatory developments, firms that are getting hit and some of the things that are being argued about in the market structure community. But, HAIMBODEK, Haim Bodek, that's my handle on Twitter. I have a website, HaimBodek.com. There are a lot of resources there. There's also a link there to a research site that I have that has lots of videos, and it's called DecimusCapitalMarkets.com, but it's best to just get to it by going to HaimBodek.com and then clicking the link. But the Decimus site has videos and white papers, probably 20 videos on there or something. You can sign up for free. There's a little, and I just approve anybody who signs up, so there shouldn't be any issue. And let me do another plug also. Just other things, if you want to hear my story, Scott Patterson wrote, or you want to read about it, Scott Patterson wrote a book called Dark Pools. I'm about a quarter of that book. It tells the whole trading machine story. There's the documentary The Wall Street Code, which I'm featured in, and that's on YouTube. There's also a documentary, the New Wolves of Wall Street, which I've got my story is also told in that. And lastly, I've got two market structure books. One, The Problem of HFT, that's what a lot of people go to after they read Dark Pools. And then we recently released a new book called The Market Structure Crisis, which really talks about all the issues, not just the high-frequency trading issue.
Excellent. Yeah, very cool. And I'll make sure to add links to all of those at chatwithtraders.com. Definitely, guys, read Dark Pools. Awesome book. I've read it. And The Wall Street Code, also highly recommend that. I mean, I've watched that probably four or five times. Such a great documentary, and you'll really enjoy it. So, Haim, thank you very much for doing this. I hope to have you on again sometime soon, because there's much more we could speak about. But, thank you, and let's talk again soon.
Okay, thanks.
You've come to the end of this episode of Chat with Traders, but don't worry, more great episodes are on the way. To stay updated with each great new episode, be sure to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes, and we'd love it if you leave us a rating and review. We'll see you next time on Chat with Traders.